All right. Thankful.
So, of course, we're running a little bit behind schedule, so I'm going to invite the two panelists, Jose Luis and Piero, to join us. So we have two invited discussants and participants on the panel representing the views from the markets. Piero Ghesi, who is the is managing director and is the head of economics and emerging markets research at Barclays, PhD in economics from UC Berkeley, Peruvian. He worked at the Ministry of Finance in Peru at one point. He was at Deutsche Bank before. And Jose Luis Escrivá, also a very good friend until quite recently, head of research, global research at BBVA, 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 the global bank, the global Spanish bank, now the director of global public finance at BBVA. So I don't know who's going to start. Do you want to begin?
Okay. Thanks very much, Mauricio and Eduardo, for the invitation. I really enjoyed both the paper and the presentation. Let me just make a few comments on the issues that I think are worth discussing. I think the introduction quite properly talks about, highlights the failure of fiscal policy, right? Of moving from, of adjusting now that Latin America has moved from a recession to overheating and inflation, right? I mean, and they also correctly mentioned that the issue is not fiscal sustainability anymore, right? The issue is just business cycle adjustment, right, in Latin America. But I just wonder to what extent we are discussing a lot of this new policy toolkit just because fiscal policy is not doing enough. To what extent, if we think of fiscal policy as being extremely out of whack with the business cycle, with economic reality, really we should not be needing all of this heavy lifting from the central banks. So I think, like, to one extent, that's the first comment I'd like to make. The second is about the role of credit, right? I think, like, if the real issue is financial stability, probably would be useful to see to what extent the different tools that we are discussing actually are effective in reducing credit that seems to be so growing so rapidly in a few of these countries. I think, like, it would be very nice to discuss now or later about how the different measures really affect one of the key variables that matter. I wrote here things. Okay. On the Dutch disease, I really like the taxonomy between, you know, like financial Dutch disease and more of the typical traditional Dutch disease. And clearly, let's say countries like Argentina benefit a lot more of the traditional Dutch disease, or are affected more by traditional Dutch disease, with other countries like Peru or Brazil are getting a lot of both. I think the distinction is a lot blurrier than what it's in the paper, right? I mean, it's a very useful and nice taxonomy, but at the end of the day, the truth is that some countries with very unstable legal frameworks, right, with not obvious property rights, are actually receiving less FDI. And a lot of the FDI that some countries are receiving, like Brazil, Peru, Colombia, are because of the commodity prices as well. So I think, like, there's a lot of both are together. And now Mauricio mentioned something in the presentation, right, about what if, and Eduardo, what if China slows down to 7%? I don't think it's, I mean, like, that can happen. I mean, I think the most likely scenario is that China will not be growing at 10% in the medium term. But it's not obvious to me that the natural implication of that is that commodity prices are going have a large correction downwards. I think, like, we did some analysis in Barclays once a year. We take some time and do something. We take more time than usual and do, like, something with longer shelf life, and we produce something called the equity yield study. And what we did there is try to analyze, let's say, the long-term structural determinants of commodity prices. And what we found out there is that really the supply-demand imbalance is gigantic. So even if China slows down, it's not obvious to us that you are going to see a correction in commodity prices. And now if we assume that there's a little bit of a permanent component, right, and I think we need to believe there's something permanent to the increasing commodity prices. It's not just financial speculation, right? Obviously, financial speculation exacerbates the cycles, but there's something more structural, right? I mean, we have seen the global recovery has not been as strong as to justify the increased commodity price. So if we believe there's at least a permanent component in commodity prices, is it that bad that the manufacturing sector has to adjust, at least to a certain extent? I think probably we need to make a distinction between more of the temporary and, let's say, the policy that you would like to do under temporary conditions and under cyclical changes in commodity prices. Fourth, moving on the effectiveness of FX intervention, I think that I think the authors are obviously Mauricio and Eduardo right in the idea that it's so difficult to measure equilibrium exchange rates that probably it's useful to say it's whatever prevails right under current fundamentals if there's no intervention. Now, they also distinguish between policy concerns about, let's say, the level of the exchange rate and the risk that the exchange rate is reversed down the line because fundamentals change, right? Because commodity prices collapse or capital flows grow. Now, I'm not truly convinced. And obviously, it makes a lot more sense to talk about a smoothing FX intervention. But I'm not totally convinced that central banks don't care about the level, right? I mean, it's obviously easy to justify. I really care much more about volatility, but I don't target a certain level. But at the end of the day, I think, like, we need to care. There is a reason to care about appreciation at the end. Say, policymakers and politicians respond to your constituencies, it makes sense to care about what the industrialists in Sao Paulo think about exchange rates. So at the end of the day, I believe that there may be, even though we're talking about smoothing volatility, there may be a reason to believe that there may be something more in the minds of central bankers. And then this intertemporal optimization discussion may not be the right point for this, right? Now, obviously, I think I have to agree with the fact that that the markets overshoot. I'm not sure if central banks know more than the markets, right? I am willing to give that as well. But I mean, at least it would be nice to discuss further that. So if that's the case, what would be the optimal policies tools that we would like to utilize for that? Let me see. Just a couple of four things on the FX. On the effectiveness of intervention, right? I think nothing against Peru, right? Obviously, but we have had so many countries that have intervened and used Peru as an example. It's just it would be nice to have seen more of a development of the Brazil example or Chile or other countries that have intervened. Peru is very unique, right? I mean, the central banks, has so much control of the banking system in general that Chinese would be ashamed. So to that extent, to use it as an example, I'm not sure it really characterizes Latin America. Second thing, I think it's not in this paper you mentioned it. You really say that the cost of sterilization really is very small. I'm not sure. I didn't see the previous paper, so it's difficult for me to understand. But I would say two things. Clearly, even if it was small, it should be increasing to extent that the carry or the interest rate differential, like everybody is tightening, whereas the U.S. doesn't appear to be tightening anytime soon. So at least in that respect, the cost of the recession has to be moving higher. Second, there's this very nice idea, but I think it's an idea that made more sense 5 years ago, that more reserve reduced the country risk premium. If Brazil adds $1 additional billion of reserves, I can tell you that CDS doesn't go down 1 basis point. At this point, it doesn't matter. That was a story in 2004, 2005, when we really were concerned about the cushion that countries would have. But at this point, an additional $1 billion of reserve in Brazil or Peru or Chile are not going to do a lot. Now, on the effectiveness of stopping inflows, I'm going to take issue with the idea that capital controls, in certain cases at least, cannot be both, the word that Eduardo used was, damaging and useless at the same time. Okay? I, I, you know, like supposed to be a contradiction, and I can see how it can be seen in general, right? I think, like, I fully agree. I mean, like, it's natural to see a gap between that onshore and the offshore interest rate and between onshore and offshore prices in the price of capital contracts. That's natural to see. Now, I think Eduardo and Mauricio also implied that naturally maps into also, an effect on the exchange rate. And that gap, I don't think, line of argument, I don't think necessarily follow. Imagine you have a tax, right, for a sake of an example, you have a tax, an IOF tax of 10%, right, on an IPO in Brazil, right? Foreign investors are the buyers of this IPO, and suddenly there's a 10% tax. So what probably happens in that case is that the domestic price of the company falls by 10%, okay? That's a theoretically reasonable assumption. If that happens, your net after-tax price is the same, and the economics of actually investing in the company do not change for a foreign investor. So the flows do not necessarily change, and the effects doesn't necessarily change. So in other words, to a certain extent, the larger the effect on asset prices, the less the newer effects has to adjust. So obviously not all cases, I'm not saying that this is true all the time, but I said you can think of cases where the adjustment actually happens through asset prices, economics of the trade do not change for an investor, and actually capital flows, and then the effects doesn't adjust. So there's almost a trade-off between the asset price adjustment and the effects adjustment. So for long-duration assets, right, or for equities, right, where foreign investors are biggest holders of those assets, actually you do have a cost, which is that lower price of the asset, higher interest rate, and it's useless in the extent that to extend that the FX actually does not depreciate. So I think that you can construct that we theoretically, that I don't think crazy, where you actually can see the both useless and damaging capital interventions. Obviously, and the other thing is the typical criticism of capital inflows. I'm not going to defend Washington Consensus or anything like that, but obviously if you have closed substitutes, even if there is a wedge in the interest rates onshore and offshore, you can always circumvent those, and you know it's not obvious that the assets are going to escape and FX is going to really depreciate. Two more things, right? One on, you told me 10 minutes, 10, 15 minutes, right? That's fine. Two more things. First, on reserve requirements, I think like Eduardo developed it here in the presentation, it wasn't obvious in the piece. I think it's very interesting to start understanding what are the different implications of imposition of reserve requirements all over, you know, interest rates, right? I think it's not exactly the same. I can see how certain governments actually are, like Peru, for example, are increasing reserve requirements that actually reduce the carry for investors, right, and tighten monetary conditions. I don't think it's such an obvious trend in emerging markets. I think, like, you have seen Turkey for sure, a little Brazil, Peru. Asia actually is going the other way. Like, China actually is using more interest rate policy. So I think, like, at the end of the day, I think it's very interesting to see there's a couple of papers like Woodford also, right, discussing how do you expand your ISL LM framework thinking about this sort of different interest rates. And finally, and I just one more thing, I you know, like that the Peruvian chapter has a, I mean, the title is called An Unusually Calm Election, right? So I could not and nobody saw it, so I'm not gonna blame Lucho on this, right? No, but what I wanted to say is that but I wanted to bring something else, right? It's a you know, like, I totally agree with the idea that it's probably very premature to talk about that this is going to be the Latin American decade, right? It's really not obvious that this is a Mexican decade. Nothing has happened in Mexico to suppose this is going to be the Mexican decade. It's not obvious the Argentinian, Venezuelan, Ecuadorian, or Bolivian decade, right? There's at least a 50% probability that a Bolivarian wins the elections in Peru a few weeks from now, right? then you are left, and Chile is unique. It has always been unique, so I don't think it's that different this time than in the past. So at the end, you are down to Colombia and Brazil. So what has happened in Peru, I think I find it particularly interesting, right? You have a country that not only has grown, right, at 8% per year, has been among the top five performers over the last 5 years, has reduced poverty from 54% to 34% in 4 years, and you have not included in 2010, so probably it was to 30%. So it's more 20 percentage points of reduction of poverty. And then you have two anti-systemic candidates getting 56% of the votes, right? You have Humala, obviously, is obviously against the economic system, but Fujimori is against the political system. So you have a huge case there to make of something else. Something is going wrong. Obviously, there are specificities to Peru. The lack of political parties obviously makes the elections much more volatile, much more fragmented, and leadership a lot more, you really need a leader as opposed to a party. But I think other countries, Colombia, have seen also certain destruction of institutions, less obvious political parties. There are other issues going on in Colombia, like security, having overriding issues. But looking forward, I think we are pretty, we should be conservative, and before declare victory and believing that this is a Latin American decade, I think we really need to think twice. That's it. Thank you.
Thank you, Piero. Thank you. On that optimistic note, José Luis, you have about 10, 15 minutes.
Okay, thank you. No, first of all, I would like to say that I like the report very, very, very much. I tend to agree with the thrust of the report, no doubt, on policy recommendation and also on the assessment on how to deal with a situation which is going to prevail on the macro side in the years to come, which is rather complex from terms of macro management. Because this is it. I mean, if we tend to envisage what is going to be the most likely scenario in the years to come, I would say that it might not differ very much what we have seen in 2010 or what is happening now. I tend to believe first that it's going to be a scenario with very, very low interest rate worldwide, probably lower what markets are expecting now. That's at least my view. This is going to continue giving rise to very abundant liquidity in Latin American countries, and also continue exerting pressure downwards on risk premium that to me would move to too low a premium and too low a price of risk. This is the first ingredient. The second ingredient is high commodity prices. There seems to be consensus. I think that, again, here the downside scenarios looks very unlikely. We are in a very, very long cycle of high commodity prices. And even if you take a very, very long view, prices, actual real commodity prices, doesn't seem to be so high, particularly, I would say, for food and even for some metals. Oil is much more complex to guess. So this is the second element that is going to be present in the region in the years to come. The third is what is going to be the policy mix prevailing. Okay, what we are witnessing so far is overall, I would say, a economic stance which might not follow the advance in the cycle. We are witnessing a resistance to adjust fiscal policy to the level that the cycle requires, particularly given the limits that the monetary policy is finding because of the exchange rate appreciation and the problems in the external front. So fiscal policies in the region should be tighter already and should go further in the years to come, and I doubt this is going to be the case. Hopefully it is, but in my central scenario, I would tend to believe that they are going to fall below it would should be needed. Here, as always, when talking about Latin America, sorry, it's a sort of proviso I should have mentioned from the outset. Certainly, there are differences across countries. What I say, maybe not applicable for some countries or only partly, but I'm trying to depict an overall picture for a region, which is, as usual, is very difficult because it's very heterogeneous. But okay, I think for the sake of this presentation, I will continue this way. So I would say fiscal, they're going to be also a great deal of resistance to exchange rate appreciation. To me, more appreciation should be allowed. I know this is an extremely tricky issue, but in a way it's going to be unavoidable. But the fact that the exchange rate, there's a tendency to quasi-pegging, or at least in terms of intention, this creates, gives rise to even a more abundant liquidity situation and a booming. The fourth element, I think, in the picture will be, is, I would say, limited progress on fiscal reform. So the expansion of the potential output will not go as far as probably desirable. What we can see so far, I mean, Mexico has been mentioned, I think, is a case in point. I mean, a period of nearly 12 years with governments, the expectation of them was very, very, very highly prone to towards reforms. I mean, the political constraint had been huge, and finally the outcome is to see at the most a middle-of-the-road approach to far-reaching reforms. I mean, that's the way I would put it. But this can be extrapolated to other countries in the region. Let's see. There are governments with entering with very good attitudes, but at the end of the day, political constraints, the need to forge majorities in the country, the lack of consensus in the society and in the political elites about the desirability of, let's say, micro-reforms, it's a major problem in the region. So if we combine these four elements, this external environment, very low rates, with risk premia narrowing down further in the region, high commodity prices, this policy mix I mentioned, plus this, digamos, limited advance in the expansion of the output in a structural manner, I mean, the key, what we are going to see in the region in the years to come is very overheated economies. I mean, it seems to me that this is unavoidable. How this overheating is going to be reflected? My impression is that, unlike what others think, we are not going to see major inflation, with some exceptions. Something we have learned in monetary policy over the last 20 years, I would say probably is the most important thing to me, is that the anchoring of inflation expectation at a certain level is extremely powerful. And what we see already in the region at different levels, you might discuss whether this is already price stability as such or not, but when you remove the transient elements of inflation, what you see in most countries in the region, with notable exception, of course, but I would say the most orthodox countries in the region, you see inflation stabilizing at decent levels consistently already for nearly a decade here and there, even longer for some period. I think this anchoring is going to work with the current shocks far more than people expect. But the abundant liquidity will be there. Overall, macro policies are going to be laxed. So I think that what we are going to have is asset bubbles. Where and when? Difficult to guess, but the conditions are there to have such elements in the region, maybe real estate, other asset classes, but that's, to me, going to be the way all this liquidity, all this excess liquidity, all these laxist conditions are going to be channeled through the economy, not necessarily in headline inflation. I mean, that's something I think we have learned from various episodes across countries over the last few years. Against this background, I would say the situation is going to be very challenging for policymakers in the region. On the fiscal front, I think that there is a need, that we have seen this in Europe very clearly, that in the periods of boom, I mean, you really need to go much further on fiscal consolidation than you tend to believe. There is a tendency to over-appreciate transient revenues which are not proved to be structurally there when the downturn comes. I mean, this is, and in the region, I tend to believe this is going to be the case again. So, I think it's going to be very tough. There is already signs that the current stance on the fiscal front is not tight enough, but this is going to be a challenge in the years to come. On the monetary policy, since I might be wrong, but if I'm right, that inflation doesn't move outwards as now is expected by markets or even by central banks, there are going to be some limits to the increase in the rates, all the more given that the chain rate appreciation will continue and will be a great deal of resistance. So at the end of the day, we might see a very strong credit growth. Very strong credit growth is going to be something which we are already witnessing more in some countries than others, but that's something going to be with us. And this is going to be a key policy, going to give rise to key policy dilemmas. My impression is that all what we are witnessing now with this macro, the discussion in the paper, I think, is very interesting on macro prudential measures on the external front. My view here is that, I think that the discussion maybe next year is going to be on macro prudential measures now, or let's say not market oriented measures on the domestic front. As we have seen in Asia, in other countries, this is going to be the new issue. For probably for the next year discussion, but okay, just briefly on what is in the paper, I tend to agree. To me, we have to be very pragmatic on these issues of interventions or let's say non-market mechanisms to avoid appreciation. They should be kept as they work. As soon as you see distortions or severe distortions, you should be prepared to remove it, not be particularly fond of anything, and limited expectations about their power. I tend to agree. This allows to smoothen out the chain rate path, but don't expect that you have found something magic that is going to work all the time and in all circumstances. Basically, what you have to do is to introduce two-way risk in the market. To the extent not only you are making more expensive some positions, but at the same, I think it's also important that markets are sometimes uncertain about how these measures are going to work. And this is a way of introducing two-way risk in the exchange rate market when people are in a one-way bet mood. So I think that may work. My expectations, and I think it's your view, are limited, but should be tested. I'm not particularly pragmatism here. But to me, the major challenge, because here we are talking about the major challenge going to be on the domestic front. And the situation looks already, as I said, in some countries as even more advanced than I could have had expected on overheating. Current account deficits are widening. You see a lot of pressures already on some sectors. So I think that credit is going to continue growing very fast. And here, the region sooner or later need to test what Asia has done in terms of not market-driven. I think there are not other alternatives. Unless they are really prepared to embark on a very, very tight fiscal policy, that would be my choice, but I think it's not going. I understand the dilemmas. It's not easy at all. And also, infrastructure deficit. I mean, when you look at the issue, you see how complex it is. But that said, I think you will need to test Asian-type macro measures, not market-driven. Are they going to work? I don't know. This is not Asia. Latin America is not Asia. When we have tried in developed countries some of these measures, I mean, it's much more difficult. With far more advanced financial system and less regulated than in Asia, much more openness of the financial account, seems to me that this is still something to be tested. But it's going to be unavoidable because the region is going to be subjected to huge pressure in the years to come. And just one word, on the long term, I think that the next 3-4 years are decisive in order to do a number of things to be able to expand this potential output. And here I think that infrastructures, I mean, there are already capacity constraints which are visible in some countries on infrastructure, on human capital, no doubt, on transportation, where unless decisive measures are taken in the next few years with a huge involvement of the private sector and with an environment which is really conducive to bring a private sector, because like public money and because of the fiscal consolidation mood ahead is going to be more difficult, the region will not be able to grasp this opportunity for a quantum leap to, let's say, levels of income per capita above 15, on average, over $15,000. I mean, that's my view.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, thank you very much. I think we have 15 minutes before we move into the next segment, where we're going to hear the Minister of Finance of the Republic of Colombia and the Governor of the Central Bank of Chile. So I encourage you to participate at this point. I see Guillermo Perry, Arturo Porcekansky. So please make your comments or questions as briefly as possible. There is a microphone somewhere. I just saw someone running out. I don't think it was...
You can voice.
Oh, yeah.
Speak up. I tend to agree a lot with the vision of Greece. And my main question when looking at the report
was why you didn't include into the toolkit the macroprudential financial regulation. Because that, in my view, theoretically at least, could be an additional toolkit, not just for financial stability, for avoiding the financial risk of these credit booms. But it can help mitigate the cycle and the consumption cycle and the current account cycle and the real exchange rate cycle as well. So I think that an evaluation of a new toolkit, which I agree, I think countries should do as much as they can. Sensible, but use all these instruments as much as they can. I think there is a real important issue behind this, even if it lasts for a couple of decades. But saying that, I think we should look at actual experience with this mechanism. There are three countries that already have had this macroprudential financial regulation, Spain, and more recently Peru and Colombia. And it could be useful to see what happened in this past cycle with this. I have seen mixed evaluations of the Spanish case, so my question is to José Luis. It seems that it was working, and suddenly it was relaxed in the worst moment, so at the end it was not so useful, but that's a question. I have seen a recent paper evaluating the case of Peru that seems that it did help in smoothing somehow the credit growth during the last cycle, and probably the Colombian case was too soon. So my question is, what evidence is there on that? Because I do think that is something that we should add to the toolkit, definitely.
Thank you, Guillermo. Arturo.
Thank you. I just wanted to emphasize the points that José Luis and Piero made. I think that we are witnessing a major failure of fiscal responsibility in Latin America. And I don't think that the paper really comes out sharp enough on this. In some of the country chapters, it's mentioned. But, I mean, consider a few things. First of all, we just had the central bank president of Brazil speaking, and he didn't even utter the words fiscal policy, never mind characterize it. I have a feeling that he would have nothing good to say. That's why. Second, when even Chile abandons its fiscal rule, and this is 2.5 years after the onset of the financial crisis, and there are no plans to bring it back, and there are structural fiscal deficits for as long as the eye can see, and the central bank is left alone having to tighten liquidity to deal with the coming overheating. You know there is a problem, because we're not just talking about the Venezuelas, Argentinas, and Ecuadors of this country. There is a big problem, and I think it's a lot easier both for economists and for policymakers to discuss putting on a tax on foreign capital inflows than dealing with a real problem, which is the growth, out-of-control growth of government spending.
Thank you. Anyone else? Are you going to begin your talk? Jose Gregorio.
I have a question for Piero. No, this is. I think that Piero made a very good point that it bothers me for a long time. And he said, well, in Peru, that's his opinion, there are two anti-systemic candidates that, well, they are going in the second round, so there is no way out. Now, I think that truly countries become serious when changes in the political in the political coalition do not derail stability. So the change of Brazil became stable when Lula was president. So this is, I think, that Chile became very stable when, after the return to democracy, free market economy prevailed and macroeconomic stability. So I think that's a key. So perhaps, regardless of what you think about your preferences, I think that this is the real test, perhaps. And from here, we'll have great Peru for very long time, despite whatever happening in politics.
Thank you. And in defense of what's written in the report, that this section on Peru was written by Luis Carranza, I think when he says that the elections have been unusually dull, it's not about the cast of characters. It is about the topics of the discussion. I don't know if you saw the presidential debates. I did see them. And in the presidential debates, they all agree on the same programs. You know, whatever was proposed, they all agree. There was a wide consensus. So dull in terms of ideas, not so dull in terms of who's running.
It's unusually calm.
Yes, you had a question.
Yeah, just a comment about Jose Luis about low real commodity prices. They reached record levels since early 70s. Corn was $8 a bushel last week. France is hosting a G20, and that's, as far as I can see, the top of the agenda of what we're going to do about that. Which brings me to the chapter two, which argues that high food commodity prices are due to liquidity, low U.S. exchange rates, speculation, growth in demand from Asia. But if you look at the data carefully, and now recent studies coming out, Asia's been a net exporter of food grains, and there's been no shock in demand or supply in the food grains, causing the 2007, 2008, and now, again, high food commodity prices. Exchange rate has been moderate, and the speculation has also shown not to be. The key shock that's caused low stocks-to-use ratio that led us to the 2007, 2008 food commodity prices has been one source, and that's been biofuels from rich countries' policies of subsidizing them, having high import tariffs. And that has been the primary reason, not shocks in demand or supply from Asia or anywhere else, or speculation for that matter. And why is that important for Latin America is because if we didn't have these silly protectionist policies in Europe, Canada, the United States, and elsewhere for biofuels, it would be produced, ethanol would be produced in developing countries with a comparative advantage. They'd be getting the direct benefits of any biofuels and not the direct costs as they are now with high commodity prices that would be at the top of the agenda in the G20 in June.
Thank you. Any other comment? Yes, gentleman in the back.
It's about the Brazilian participation in the...
Can you speak up a little bit?
Yeah, I can. Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Okay. It's about the Brazilian participation in Latin America GDP. It's the highest in two decades. So I want to know if there's some kind of systemic risk for the region, or if it's a good, or it's not a matter of concern. That's it.
All right. Anyone else? Well, if not, then let's come back to the panel. I think there are questions for everyone. Maybe you can start taking
the Peru one.
Well, there was a question about Peru. There are a few questions to you, and then we'll both end with our own reflection on the report. And by the way, we'll have 5 minutes for this. So, be brief.
Yeah, I just answer to about, you know, like, I think the difference in the case of Peru, I mean, if you compare Peru with Brazil, I think is, I mean, like, in a way, Brazil came after Lula lost a few elections and actually had already modified his speech and his economic policy making. I think in the case of Peru right now, like somebody, some political analyst from Harvard put it, with Humala, we have questions. With Fujimori, we have certainties, right? We knew that Fujimori killed, robbed, et cetera, et cetera. With Humala, we don't know what's going to happen, right? Now, if Humala turns out to be a good policymaker, I mean, he moved to the center in economic policies, that would be more because he has been moved by certain people. But I don't think right now it's in his... if you talk to the guys who are managing his economic policies, I don't think you see a lot of sensical policies yet. So I think it may converge there, but I think it will be chance. So, and I think I don't think we have seen in Peru yet the sort of transition from ayornamiento from the left to a more central policy. So I think it's I hope that's the case. I hope you're right.
Thank you, José Luis.
Okay, I probably should focus on Guillermo's question on the Spanish experience on financial macroprudential tools and the lesson that can be drawn for the region. I think there are two episodes which are of interest. One is less well known, but I think it's very interesting. It was in the previous cycle, Spain introduced in 1990 credit controls, direct credit controls, with ceilings to the credit that could be extended by each particular financial institution, breaking with the tradition of market-driven monetary policy for 15 years. And it worked for 1 year. I think credit dynamics were broken. There were inefficiencies, I would say, no doubt. I mean, it was across-the-board control. But I would say if you look at that episode, it helped to break a dynamic credit. And afterwards, there was not fiscal consolidation, whatever. So the crisis came in the exchange rate crisis in 1994. But at least this allowed, as I think is the case for these measures, to gain two, three years in order to give more room for more orthodox fiscal policy. So it worked for some time, which I think is the essence of this message. On the other tools that were introduced later in the mid-90s, late 90s, and I will know the anti-cyclical provisions, I would say that they worked not primarily for they were designed. They were designed in order to introduce a wedge in interest rates and to the extent that banks were going to pass this cost to the lending rates, we were expect to cool off credit. When you are in a boom, you really need to introduce a huge wedge in order to have, given that elasticity is limited. So I don't think that there were some effects, actually, when you look at what happened when there were banks pressures and this provision were relaxed somewhat in 2004, there was a further credit boom. So you can indicate that it worked somewhat. But what it was very helpful is to create a buffer so that for, I'd say, reasonable banks in terms of prudency, they have been navigating through the crisis very well without the need to access the market or capital increases. So they are helpful in this second respect. I would say they need to be tested, as Guillermo introduced and tested, as Guillermo said, but they should not be seen over a medium term as a substitute for, let's say, the right policy stance on fiscal and monetary policy. Are instruments that help to deal with the timing of the cycle.
Thank you. Eduardo.
Okay, very briefly. Guillermo, on macroprudential, yes, of course. We bunched this at the end of the report with the rest of it, but we have to write one report every 6 months, so we're keeping this for the next one. Biofuels, of course, yes. It's another source, another global source of uncertainty you have to take into account, but goes in our direction, it goes with our argument, that you still have there a shock that actually can revert very easily if the biofuel strategy actually doesn't play out. Arturo, fiscal responsibility, of course, is important, but it's just, I think, part of the story, although Mauricio probably has something else to say about this. Let me just mention three things that I think we learned or we started to think about after doing this exercise. The first one is has to do with what Piero said. I think that this idea of Latin American decade is good for marketing purposes, but it's bad for policy making because it's very difficult to manage heightened expectations. That's where the title comes from. You know, how can I tell my constituency that we are not going to grow at 7% without inflation? I mean, or vice versa, how can I actually reach a non-inflationary growth path of 7% and be like Asia? Brazil is not China. The mass media is bunching Brazil with China. That doesn't help Governor Tombini or the President or the Minister of Economics anywhere in Latin America. So I think we have to sort of fight against that. As Ilan Golfan said when we presented this, the first report last year, I think we need some counter-cyclical marketing policy, right? Because we were not that bad at the beginning of the 2000s, we are not that good right now. So we have to manage that. Managing expectations is important. Something to mention, you know, there is some contradiction here, even during the discussion, that I think we have to manage as well. You know, we have an overheating economy and we have an infrastructure deficit. I mean, look at Brazil in particular, you know, how many the investment infrastructure is needed because of these big events, right? This only adds to the problem, to the appreciation problem, to the inflationary problem. So we have to pick one of those, but we cannot actually ignore infrastructure deficit, and we are starting from an overheating situation. The fiscal front, then, is a little bit more complicated unless we want to ignore the infrastructure deficit. And finally, something I think is important to bear in mind and to follow very closely, and it's not a recent process. Yesterday, at the panel, I was discussing at the panel, and Mauricio Mesquita actually mentioned, said something that was relatively shocking, that Latin America lost the industrialization window. And he was referring essentially to the fact that we cannot compete with China, and of course, you know, Germany, you know, it happened long ago, so we are trapped into primary resources, our agro-industry, or something that we can do with these primary resources. But it's very difficult to compete on that window. Probably we will never do that. And if you look at the more general Dutch disease pictures, which is the lower decline, steadily declining share of industrial production in the GDP, that is not a problem with that doesn't come from real appreciation. That's been going on for decades, actually, and particularly in the last 10, 15 years. This is a problem. It's a problem in terms of the quality of employment that is generated. It's a problem in terms of income distribution. It's a political problem. And it's a problem because it's a long-term problem. It's very difficult to manage by politicians that have a short horizon. But I think this is a pending issue associated with exchange rate, but something that has to be discussed more profoundly. Thank you.
Well, I think there is you covered most of the responses. Let me just say a couple of words. One, on China, comment that was made by Piero. Yes, we don't know. I mean, China is a black box. What's going to happen with the commodity prices? It's very uncertain. I think the safe assumption from the point of view of policy is not to consider that that the permanent component of what's going on is the most important. It's more or less hoping for the best but preparing for the worst. I think the policy toolkit has to be set in motion in a way that does not make that assumption. It would be too risky to make the assumption that China and the demand for commodities are going to go on forever. We do provide significant evidence showing something that is interesting. We've treated these two external positive shocks, the terms of trade and capital flows as relatively independent. But when you look at the common determinants of these two shocks, you understand that it's a global cycle. It's a global cycle that, by definition, at one point is going to unfold, either because of China or because QE2 here in the United States. So we have to prepare for that. That's why the current appreciation of the currency is something you can call or that you see the symptoms of a Dutch disease. Otherwise, we will just not talk about the Dutch disease. We will talk about the adjustment to more appreciated currencies. And I think there are signs of the Dutch disease, what you just mentioned about industrialization, the high unemployment figures in some countries. So dealing with the Dutch disease, I think it's first acknowledging it and dealing with it is the key point of this report. Now, do we miss fiscal policy? No. Maybe we talk more about these other elements of the toolkit, but we by no means want to give the impression that these are substitutes to fiscal policy. These are complements to fiscal policy. I mean, and if needed, we have to do a report just talking about fiscal policy, because I think this, I mean, the basic message at the beginning of the presentation is that we still are behaving with fiscal policies as if the world economy remained in a recession. And it's very interesting to see that the countries that are more well known for the fiscal rules are actually the ones that have forgotten about it the fastest. So we really do place a lot of emphasis on the fiscal side in terms of the way we see these prudential macro policy framework and fiscal policy is a key component. At the end, our message is let's not leave the central banks alone. Central banks cannot do this. They need other measures, and fiscal is key, but also these measures on financial regulation. Now, we think that the menu is quite interesting, and we don't say that we fully endorse, but we highlight that there is something that is taking place in places like Turkey, where you create this gap between the deposit rate, which is what drives the carry trade, and the lending rate. And if you can tax that, and if you can actually design innovative ways of creating a wedge between these two rates, I think that's a way to go in terms of reducing the overheating. So with that, we'll end. Thank you to the two panelists. Great comments, as always. And thank you for the questions from the audience.